I don't know how to go there. We haven't seen the floor
Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday, April 13th edition of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means and Financial Subcommittee. We're going to start with some housekeeping measures with staff, and then we're going to go into public hearing on House Bill 1519. And in the interest of time, Hillary Abram and Chris Hagenbaumer and Karen and others from the Oregon Environmental Council who are scheduled to testify at 9 can be first. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a packet of letters that the committee has received from people in discussion of the DEQ budget that I'll pass out. And we also have a packet of information that was requested from the department on the Unitilla Chemical Agent Disposal Program that I will provide to you now. And then the agency is prepared to discuss this with you tomorrow. We'll have staff here that if the committee would like to go into this further.
So. Further, I've asked for Department of Environmental Quality to talk about environmental equity issues as well. So if we could have the opening of the public hearing on the House Bill 1519, Department of Environmental Quality budget. I will call the Oregon Environmental Council, please. Good morning. Actually, Kate, quite sensitive.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. My name is Hillary Abraham. I represent the Oregon Environmental Council. With me here today is Chris Hagenbaumer and Karen Malotsky from our organization. I'd like to thank you for letting us go first, as we had prior commitments this morning. Founded in 1968, the Oregon Environmental Council is Oregon's oldest statewide environmental group. We are a nonpartisan organization with over 1,600 members statewide. Our mission is to restore and protect Oregon's clean air and water now and for future generations. We bring Oregonians together to create and to promote socially just and economically sound environmental policies. Today, we urge you to fully fund the budget requested by the Department of Environmental Quality. Oregon's natural beauty and environmental quality attract people and businesses from across the country and are treasured by all of us lucky enough to live here. Like elsewhere, though, we have environmental problems to address. For example, many Oregon runs of steelhead and salmon are threatened or endangered. Over 11,000 miles of our streams fail basic water quality standards. Many Oregon communities are teetering on the edge of violating federal air quality standards, even at current levels. Studies estimate that particulate air pollution causes over 500 premature deaths each year in our major metropolitan areas. Now I'm going to let our Air and Transportation Program Director, Chris Hagenbaumer, speak to why funding is so critical for these programs.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Hagenbaumer. I'm the Air and Transportation Program Director at OAC. The DEQ is a recognized national leader in responding to environmental challenges in effective, creative, and cost-effective ways. DEQ is Oregon's first line of defense against air and water pollution, and it runs key programs. For example, DEQ programs like the Vehicle Inspection Program make sure expensive pollution control equipment functions properly and has brought the Portland area back into compliance with federal clean air standards. DEQ is working to develop total maximum daily loads for polluted streams that will form the foundation for logical, methodical efforts to clean them up over the coming decades. DEQ staff participate actively in efforts to solve problems creatively at the state level without simply handing power over to national regulators. Efforts to design a community-driven cleanup plan for the Portland Harbor are just one example. CDQ's Environmental Partnerships for Oregon Communities program provides the same kind of common sense flexibility for small towns across the state. There are hundreds of other examples. While we all have our complaints about DEQ as we would about any large institution, the role it plays is critical to every Oregonian's quality of life. Basically, we're here to say that you get what you pay for. It's an old expression, but a true one. It's cheap for state agencies to write one-size-fits-all rules and permits. It's far more expensive for them to customize what they do, spend time understanding specific industries, supporting creative solutions, and so on. Regulated businesses and industries have the most to gain from a top-notch DEQ. Without adequate funding, the law will still get enforced, just more sporadically, more often through citizen lawsuits, and with less certainty or skill. An underfunded DEQ is likely to mean longer processing times for permits and permit modifications, less flexibility and responsiveness to individual problems and circumstances, less technical assistance to businesses, landowners, and others, fewer inspections, making it increasingly likely that law-abiding Oregonians have to compete against, or live next door to those who flaunt our environmental laws, and finally, more uncertainty as the gap between what the law allows and what DEQ can enforce continues to grow. Worst of all, Oregon's environmental quality will decline. Problems will continue to accumulate, making it increasingly likely that we will have to deal with these problems in a crisis mode and possibly under the cloud of federal sanctions and mandates. I'd like to turn the microphone over now to our water program director to talk about some specific priorities.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Karen Lewatsky. I'm the director of water programs for the Oregon Environmental Council. We would like to highlight three particularly important elements in DEQ's 1999-2001 budget. First, cars and trucks are responsible for more than 50% of Oregon's air pollution. Addressing this problem means more than simply testing autos in the Portland and Medford areas. DEQ needs to restore general fund dollars for 5.5 FTE in the air quality department in order to address area mobile resources. Second, DEQ is asking for revenue to keep five existing water quality permitting program permit positions in place. These positions are key to the program, which regulates and attempts to minimize adverse effects of pollution in Oregon's waters. Third, setting TMDLs, total maximum daily loads, is an integral part of bringing Oregon's water bodies into compliance with state standards. It is also important for the development of an effective restoration plan for the Willamette River, including the recovery of currently listed species. Approving the DEQ's funding request for 8.5 FTE required to establish TMDLs for the Willamette River Basin will allow this work to continue while other essential work continues on TMDLs in other basins. We understand that the budget is tight. If funding these priorities proves difficult, we suggest you consider eliminating the pollution control tax credit. Oregon will spend over $27 million over the coming biennium to continue this outdated credit, which largely subsidizes existing businesses to comply with federal environmental laws. Thank you, and we would be happy to answer any questions for you.
Questions from the committee?
Senator Farmer.
Here you indicated on the first page that studies estimate that air pollution causes over 500 premature deaths each year in our major metro areas. Do you have that for our state? Do you have those figures for our state? And if you do, I'll ask you.
That figure is for the state of Oregon, for the Medford, Eugene, and Portland areas.
500 deaths is just Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is kind of a basic question, but I've never got an answer that I can understand from anyone, so I'm going to ask it from you folks. You mentioned that we've got 11,000 miles of streams that don't meet water quality standards, and I assume that part of those standards you're talking about are the temperature standards. And could you explain to me how the temperature standard fits into the TMDL? I understand TMDL when you're dealing with substances that you can measure, such as toxics or sediment or those kind of things. But I cannot, in my simple mind, make the leap to how that applies to temperature.
Mr. Chair, Representative Messerly, temperature is just one way of measuring the health or the water quality of a stream. A stream may indeed not carry toxics or pollutants in it, but by the nature of being elevated in temperature, that can affect the amount of oxygen the water carries, which can affect the habitat for species that are able to live in that water.
And how do you quantify, how do you quantify that as a maximum, total maximum?
I'm sorry, Representative Jensen, I don't know the exact answer to that. I don't know how that works.
And that's my problem. I've struggled with that for 3 years now.
Further questions for the committee? Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Call Tim Josie. Mr. Josie, it's nice to see you back in the building. I already get the perspective from local government.
How about that? Well, Mr. Chair and fellow members, my first time back testifying since leaving the legislature a couple of years
ago. Obviously, for the record, please.
For the record, I am no longer State Representative Tim Josie. I'm a county commissioner in Tillamook County. You know, and when I thought about coming before, I always knew that I'd be back and testifying, and I really thought I'd be testifying about things like roads, and I can tell you that the roads in Tillamook County are a state of disaster. But I'm sure I'll get my chance to do that. In fact, I probably just did a little testifying about a road situation. But in my wildest dreams, I didn't think that I would be coming here talking about or testifying before a Ways and Means Committee about a DEQ budget. And here I am. So I want to give you the local perspective. But what I want to do is talk a little bit about what's going on in Tillamook County. We have a national estuary project, Tillamook Bay National Estuary Project, and it's been going on for some time. That actually started, maybe 8-10 years ago. I was pretty skeptical of the process at the time, but we had an opportunity and we moved forward, and it's now moving through, it's finishing up on the study phase, and now we're going into, we're on the verge of going into the implementation phase. And we have something that's called a CCMP, which is a Comprehensive Conservation Management Plan, which is techno-speak. This is federal government techno-speak, and this sort of thing drives me nuts. What it really means is we have a plan to clean up our environment and clean up the bay and the estuary, and so I think that's important. We also in Tillamook County have 4 active watershed councils working to bring back our salmon, and I think that that's really important too, and I'm very pleased to see that happen because I worked with Senator Bill Bradbury and Representative Chuck Norris. 3 of us were really instrumental in writing the language back in 93, and then we revised it. Thank you, Senator Farrell. And then revised it in 95. And it's working really well. And incidentally, I think that one of the most important things that watershed councils can do is educate the people about what the watershed is like. And by doing that, they understand a little bit more about why our salmon are disappearing. And so it actually helps to change people's practices. And I think that's probably one of the most important things about watershed councils. Tillamook County, because of one of the things that we're known for is flooding, as you all know. I mean, we get hit really hard. We got hit in 96, and then in December, I think the 23rd or whatever of last year, we had a flood in central Tillamook County that was almost as bad, within a couple inches. So James Lee Witt, in his wisdom, developed this concept called Project Impact, developing disaster-resistant communities. And so Benton County and Tillamook County have been designated the only two counties in Oregon as project impact communities. And so we're doing a lot of really good things, and I think, and we're not a long way from there, but we're doing a lot of good things in terms of mitigating some of the flooding impacts. We've got cow pads. You know, we lost a lot of cows in the 96 flood, and so we've create these cow pads, so we get the cows on the pads during the floods, and of course it saves them. We've also raised close to 100 houses, and one of the things that that's exciting now that I just shared with Senator Tarnow is we're taking a good look at the flood dynamics, and we're looking at creating flood pads and removing the impediments. And we're finding a lot of that water backs up because of dikes back into Tolmac along 101. And so what we need to do is create spillways, remove the impediments, and enlarge some of the tide gates and the culverts and that sort of thing. And so, and then finally the other thing we're doing is we're installing fish-friendly tide gates. I can't say enough about the Tolmac Soil and Water Conservation District. They have been a really key player in this whole enterprise, not just with flood mitigation. They have been the sponsoring agency for Army Corps of Engineer feasibility study for flooding, and they've also been really the lead agency in making sure that the money gets funneled for on-the-ground projects in terms of repairing our riparian zones and making the environment more friendly for fish. So what we did is we brought all of the key players together in an organization called Performance Partnership. Now, Performance Partnership is another one of these federal techno-speaks that drives me nuts, and if I'm going to change anything, I'm going to change the name of it. What it is it brings everybody together at the table so that we can all work together and affect changes. And there are about 65 players in Tolmac County, so it's pretty comprehensive. It includes, in part, Tolmac County, the Soil and Water Conservation District, the Tolmac Flood Group, which is an ad hoc group that formed after the 96 flood, and they've been very instrumental in affecting change. And then the watershed councils, the cities, courts, various districts, the Department of Ag, FEMA, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, EPA, and finally, DEQ. And that's the reason why I'm here. So what has DEQ done for Tolmac County? During the 1998-99 cycle, Tolmac DEQ field office placed $443,693 in 319 projects within Tolmac County. And the projects include, and now most of these projects went through the Soil and Water Conservation District and the Watershed Council, but it was the local field rep from DEQ that got us the money on the ground. And it's riparian fencing, riparian planning, wetland restoration, in-stream barms. In-stream barms is a very interesting phenomenon. It just sort of redirects the water so that it no longer cuts into the bank. And it's a very effective tool that we've learned how to use very well. Fish-friendly tide gates, culvert replacement, small-scale manure storage facilities, research of function of buffer strips, water quality monitoring, public education and outreach. The DEQ field staff provides technical assistance, financial resources, and water quality monitoring equipment to the groups named above. Without these services, we wouldn't be nearly as effective at what we're doing in Tolmac County. And I think we it's exciting being a county commissioner in Tolmac because of the things that we are doing at this point in time. And DEQ has been a very key player. The DEQ field staff is also responsible for 104 wastewater discharge permits along the North Coast. They also regulate siting and construction of subsurface sewage disposal systems such as septic tanks. DEQ is working with us to solve our water quality problems, which are important for salmon recovery, but also for other things such as our oyster industry. We've got oyster industry is pretty big in Tolmac County, and we've got businesses or oyster farms in the Tillamook Bay and Neekirk Bay. And they get closed down about 100 days a year because of water quality problems. And so we're looking to solve that, too. There's room for everybody in this basin if we do things right. DEQ, due to increased program costs, without the corresponding increase in fees and federal funds, is facing the loss of 5 positions statewide in these programs. Folks, one of those positions is in Tillamook Bay, and a guy's name is Bruce Apple. He's a good friend of mine. He used to be a watershed coordinator. He now works for DEQ. He's a guy that comes to all of the meetings, has been to the performance partnership meetings, a watershed council meeting. He's been a real key player. In fact, I would say he is a key cog in this whole system. And if we lose this guy, it's going to really be detrimental for Tillamook County. And if we lose him, and I want to finish by saying that if he is that important to us, the other four positions statewide have to also be important too. So when you're working through the budget, please find a way to fund these folks for Tillamook County. Thank you.
Any questions? Sure. I'll rest that message.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tim, it's good to see you back, but I just want to ask you the question. Do you think we're gaining? We're hearing from so many people, quite frankly, that even with the efforts we presently have, we're not keeping up with the pace. From your perspective in Tillamook County, are we gaining on this water quality issue?
Yes, I really do. I mean, I named about, not all of these, but there are about 9 out of the 10 public education and outreach is important too, and I think we're gaining there because people understand now how their actions can affect fish. If you look, I'd be delighted to take you and anybody else to Tillamook and show you what we're doing in terms of just they're nuts and bolts things. Now, you and I both recognize when it comes to coho salmon, the majority of the problem is out in the ocean. We can't change that. Fortunately, we're back into the ocean conditions are moving back into a situation that's more favorable for salmon. But the fact is that we, through the course of time, have made conditions less and less favorable for salmon. And once they enter the tributaries, and so when we have adverse conditions in the ocean, the conditions that we have created for them only exacerbate the situation. We have done an awful lot in Tillamook County, but we've just scratched the surface. So we are gaining. I think we're setting ourselves up for a win-win in Tillamook County when the fish start coming back.
Further questions? Commissioner Josie, I really appreciate having you offer the testimony. We understand how valuable it can be to have those local DEQ contacts for those issues that are responsive issues that the agency needs to be helping the local agencies with. So I appreciate you bringing that message forward.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
The drive home will be just as pleasant as the drive here.
Paul Benoit.
Benoit. For the record, my name is Paul Benoit. I'm the Community Development Director for the City of Astoria. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I was asked to come here by Willis Van Guzen, who is the mayor of Astoria. And not to give you any big picture or to speak to sort of the overall budget, but specifically to tell you a little bit of a story about the city's experience with the Astoria Plywood site. And he asked me essentially to add some detail, perhaps add a few exclamation points to the letter that he forwarded to you. I believe it's in your package. The Astoria, like all coastal communities and many communities across Oregon over the last decade, have been pretty hard hit with the downturn in the fishing industry, the timber industry. It's an old story that most communities have all experienced. Astoria had a plywood mill. In fact, we had a mill site that had been in the timber products manufacturing sector since the 1870s. Astoria Plywood was a cooperative mill that started in 1954 and operated through 1991 when it shut its doors. We lost 217 jobs with that closure. As a community, we actually thought that perhaps the mill would reopen. You know, everyone, it was just a tentative thing, but in fact, it didn't. It was a permanent closure. And as a cooperative, it was worker-owned, and mom and pop, the workers just sort of left Astoria, went to other jobs. There was really no responsible party left to take care of the assets of the mill site. As time passed, a year or two, about 1992-93, we learned more about the mill site. Again, it was it's a 16-acre site. It's on Highway 30. It's adjacent to Columbia River Maritime Museum, next door downtown. It's on the Columbia River. It's a very prominent 16-acre site in town, and if you know Astoria, there's really only one way in and one way out of Astoria. You can't come or go without driving past the mill site. Well, in 92, the Small Business Administration showed up on the site. We learned not only did we lose sort of jobs with that closure, but the mill left about $5 million in debt, and about $3 million of that to the Small Business Administration. SBA came in, and they began doing some environmental testing on the property. As we later learned, their interest was in trying to recover the $3 million. After a good sort of number or degree of testing on the property, they came to the conclusion that they actually did not want the real estate. They'd take anything else. It's a personal asset, the personal property, but the real estate they found to be too contaminated. They didn't want it. They held an auction on the site to auction off all of the mill equipment and buildings. And following that auction in 93, it was amazing to watch what happened. It was like termites descending on the property. There were scavengers, successful bidders in these auctions who descended on that property uncontrolled. And literally, people bid on the floor, they bid on the trusses, they bid on the equipment, anything that anyone saw value in, metal siding on buildings, they came in and took their little pieces. And what they left was a site that essentially looked worse than the town dump. At least at our dump, there were people kind of pushing things from piles and organizing it. The mill site, after the auction, was a horrible mess. On the ground, on the surface, let alone what we were learning to be under the surface. As a community, we found most of the responsible agencies, again, whether it was Classic County for tax purposes or SBA trying to recover loans, the effort on that site by many was to recover whatever they could, take whatever was of value and shed any responsibility. And it just slowly began to dawn on the city as a community that there wasn't anyone here to take care of the problem. Nobody was home. And so the city took responsibility, perhaps not legal responsibility, but we took it upon ourselves to try to solve the problem. The problem being we're very limited in our land base in Astoria. We're an old community. Most of the land that's developable is already built on. The only opportunities we have for economic development really are infill or redevelopment as old things leave. The mill site, again, 16 acres next to our downtown, just couldn't be ignored, so we didn't ignore it. We did everything we could to try to find a way to fix the problem, even though at that point we didn't quite know what the scope of the problem was. We worked with the Federal Economic Development Administration. We were able to get ourselves as a community, and that the site part of the Oregon Mill Site Conversion Project. That was in the early 90s. It was a project funded by the Economic Development Administration and co-funded by Pacific Power. And it was, again, we were one of seven mill sites across the state in similar circumstances that was being where some federal dollars were being spent to learn a little bit more about the property. We just got these little incremental pieces of information as time went on, and it just painted a very bleak picture for us. We were getting some attention, but we found, in fact, through those efforts, that the cleanup costs that were estimated on this property were about $1.4, $1.5 million. That was a conservative estimate. We had an appraisal done on the property that said it was worth about $900,000. So we had cleanup costs exceeding property values, and again, it's just more bad news. Around 1994, 95, again, the city was just very persistent in trying to find a way to solve this problem. In 94, 95, we approached Department of Environmental Quality. And actually, as mentioned in the mayor's letter, we had spent the last 3 years trying to learn all we could do and try to find some help somewhere. We approached DEQ after several years in the process, and again, as the mayor pointed out, we did it with a little reticence. We were concerned that would open Pandora's box, as many communities or private businesses, you know, they don't necessarily want to let DEQ into their lives for fear of what they may be told they need to do. To our great surprise, frankly, and actually, we shouldn't have been surprised, because I think our reticence was based more on ignorance than anything else, really, because the DEQ cleanup staff were incredibly helpful. I mean, not only did they completely understand the situation, because they had dealt with it sort of many times in the past, but they also understood the community's concern for economic development. You know, it wasn't just public health. I mean, that certainly was important, but it was, for the city, it was really an economic development issue in addition. And the DEQ staff understood that and worked with us. And over the course of the next 2 years, they worked with the city, and the cleanup, and there's a long story, and I'm going to try to cut to the quick here. The property was cleaned by DEQ with assistance from the city, financial assistance from the city, in 1996. The property now is, again, as I mentioned, clean, but that was only half the problem for us. It's a relatively depressed community. We wanted to see it redeveloped. Under the new cleanup laws, as you all, I'm sure, know, you are allowed now, depending on land use issues, to leave contaminants in place. You address the hot spots, but you don't have to clean it back to a pristine state. Again, you can manage contaminants that are left on the property. That, on the one hand, is good. It makes it affordable, and it certainly made this cleanup affordable, but it also is a real challenge to the private sector. Again, the city, half our goal was to clean it up. The other half was to get someone interested in redeveloping and getting it back on the tax rolls. And that is where we really sort of stretched. Well, I wouldn't say stretched DEQ, because, again, they understood, but DEQ really became our partners. And I'm talking about the cleanup division in particular, and I'm not talking about one particular person. There's actually a long list from the project managers on up through the cleanup division. We just had sort of a wonderful experience with all of them. And in particular, as we developed a land use redevelopment plan for that site, and we began marketing, so we marketed it throughout the region, throughout the Northwest region. And we had developers interested, but we fully disclosed the condition of the property in our advertisements. And we invited the developers to please contact DEQ. We gave them the names and phone numbers of the people within the agency that we had worked with, just as part of full disclosure, and said, talk to them. And DEQ, again, worked with us, worked with the development community, and really made a very complex problem very simple. And again, at this point, I'm not surprised by that anymore, but at the time, it was sort of continual amazement, at least for our city council in particular. One really sort of critical part of this whole process was the drafting of a prospective purchaser agreement. And again, you may be familiar with those. I wasn't until a couple of years ago. But it's basically a contract, an agreement that we, as a city, or any cleanup entity, whether it's a private business or a municipality, can enter into with DEQ, that says in return for doing certain things on the property, promoting the cleanup and protecting the property, DEQ takes on certain responsibilities for any contaminants that may be found in the future on the property. For instance, a concern of any developer is, on a property that particularly has a history like the Assyria Plywood site has, is what do they do if the bulldozers are running, they're paying the mortgage, and they run into something else? On a 16-acre site, you don't know if you've got everything. And, if suddenly everything grinds to a halt while you're still paying the mortgage, it's a real problem. We, as a city, sort of understood that was going to be a concern of the private sector. Any developer that we could attract to this site is going to have that concern. You're going to want some assurances. And so as we negotiated with DEQ, we as a city tried to put ourselves in the private sector's role. And that's often difficult for municipalities to think private sector, really. But we could have been happy just to enter into an agreement that would protect the city. You know, wash our hands, set the site clean and just be free of it and we can move on to another project. But we felt really that that wasn't going to be sufficient. So in taking that view of the developer, we worked with DEQ, we were concerned, and we said, okay, what if? You know, what if we sell this property? What if the bulldozers are running and the foundation's getting dug and something gets run into it? Not enough for DEQ to tell us that you're not responsible, you know, that you won't be liable for this. Because, again, that's only half the issue. The other issue is, well, who is going to be responsible and what kind of time frame will they be responsible and how are you going to pay for it? DEQ, again, as we brought these issues up in our negotiations with them, could have ducked and dodged, really, because we were asking a lot. But, again, they understood that issue. They really, truly seemed committed to working with the city to see this project work and see this property return to the tax roll. And, in fact, I think we were able, with sort of DEQ's efforts, to negotiate a fairly novel agreement and a new approach. And in essence, what happened in this case is DEQ agreed that the city of Astoria share of the cleanup on this property is $625,000. In fact, we should be delivering a check to DEQ tomorrow in that amount. DEQ, as part of the agreement with us, have agreed to, in essence, have a quick response fund of the funds that we're paying to DEQ. They agreed for a three-year period that they would use a portion of the funds that we provide them as a set-aside to respond to any problems that may occur on that site during the pre-development and development phase. And again, the partnership that we developed with DEQ was what made this project work. You know, without DEQ and their understanding, not just the technical issues, but the economic development issues, the Astoria Mill site, I'm convinced, would still be the town dump. And now, this summer, WANA Federal Credit Union, it's a credit union on the coast, is going to be building a new 30,000 square foot headquarters building on that property. It's slated for development of up to 214 new residential units and associated commercial development. And that's all going to start this summer. And it's going to start this summer because of the effort that DEQ made on this property. And just in conclusion, and I'll just sort of quote from the mayor's sort of final paragraph here, you know, where he says that the Astoria Mill site is now clean and ready for redevelopment. Our success in this cleanup was a direct result of the perseverance, understanding, and support of DEQ's cleanup division staff. The agency's focus on finding affordable, achievable solutions to environmental cleanups is exactly the right approach. As you review the agency's budget, please keep our experience in mind. It's critical that DEQ have the resources to be available to communities and businesses as they were available to Astoria. I personally worked with DEQ staff in the cleanup division in a good number of them. It wasn't just one individual who was stellar. It was a long list. And, you know, their approach and their help was very genuine. It wasn't because it was another government entity. I think that the assistance they provided the city, they provide to any private business or any other municipality. And, again, our site's clean, and we're done, and we're off to redevelopment. But if preserving their budget, particularly, again, for the cleanup division, that's what I'm most familiar with, can help other communities or businesses accomplish what we accomplished, then it's all worth it. And so the mayor would just ask your consideration as you move through the budget process.
Thank you. When the mill site was redeveloped and they did the soil testing, there were some contaminants that were found in the soil. What were those?
They were PCBs, solvents, petroleum products, primarily petroleum products. I personally had not had experience with projects like this or environmental cleanups like this. I personally went down to the site and watched it during part of the cleanup. And again, to the layperson, it was amazing when DEQ and their contractor came in. They were excavating pits. They would excavate down to the water on the site, about 6 feet deep. And each morning, there'd be about a 6-inch scum layer of petroleum products that would just leach out of the surrounding soil onto the surface of the water. And they'd siphon that off, I thought it was done. He'd come back the next morning, there's a 6-inch layer. And they literally took they extracted about 8,000 gallons of petroleum products from those pits. But again, being a plywood mill, the glues, the solvents, the hydraulic fluids, it was all there. There was they found buried capacitors. I know they're used in the electrical components, but they found 30 or 40 capacitors just buried over the site.
When the removal was accomplished, they actually excavate the contaminated soil and move it to a disposal site, or was it treated on the site?
It was treated on the site, and they, as they did the investigation up front, sort of the analysis, and began looking at the different cleanup options, they investigated many different options, some of which would be hauling the soil off, bringing cleanup equipment on. They really looked for the most affordable methodology to clean it up. And in this case, they identified the hot spots, which is the worst of the worst. It's the stuff that's got to go. And they brought in, the technical name, but it's a thermal treatment process, a big furnace. And they would excavate the soil, and they would sift it to get out the wood and metals, and they'd put the soil in basically this thermal remediation unit that would just burn off the oil. It would volatilize sort of all the contaminants and then recycle that back into some kind of holding bin. That took about two months time to accomplish the cleanup.
Was the site cleared by DEQ? In other words, is it now no longer considered a contaminated site?
I think once a brownfield, perhaps always a brownfield, until the earlier days when you actually had to clean up to background, make the site like it was before industry was there. At that time, you could say it was clean. Now, it's still a contaminated site. There are, as part of the cleanup work, DEQ mapped out and surveyed areas of no excavation, where there's contaminants left in place sufficient that you just cannot excavate there. They also mapped out areas that had to be capped. We have about a 3-foot clean soil cap over several acres of the site. One of the things that I should mention in that, and I hope you don't mind, I'm giving perhaps longer answers to short questions here, but they, in this process, we had begun developing a relationship with a developer who was interested in the property. That developer was in contact with DEQ, and the DEQ cleanup staff worked with the developer and his architect just hand-in-hand to ensure that as the architect developed the site plan, they did the plat and developed the public spaces, the roads, the water, the sewer lines, that those were laid out in a way that didn't run through those no excavation areas. Because we were able to work hand-in-hand with DEQ and the architect and the developer, they were able to come up with a site plan that really avoided the areas of concern. And for instance, the credit union that is going to be developed this summer were able to design their building and place their parking lot in the area where the soil cap was going to be. So it was really a partnership, not just with the city, but also with the developer. But it definitely is a contaminated property. There are deed restrictions on the property. We'll be doing groundwater monitoring on that site for the next 10 years. The site has a 3-acre pond that's tidal. It's connected to the Columbia River. DEQ is requiring that a new weir be installed at the mouth of the pond to control the inflow and outflow of water in order to keep the sediments in the pond covered all the time, again, because of the concern for existing contaminants.
So I can assume that in the pond there are disposed dredge soils or contaminated soils where there has to be a water cap and all.
Very definitely. And had we been required to excavate the sediments, and as I understand, that's a much more difficult task than sort of the land-based problem, had we been required to clean the sediments, it just wouldn't have been done. The cost would have been so far in excess of the value on the property to clean up when it's been done. So, again, by these other remedial efforts, like raising the level of the weir to raise the water level in the pond, to have the water cap, doing some of those controls was sufficient to sort of get the sign-off from DEQ and to satisfy the redeveloper on the property.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to call Roger Everett from Deschutes County.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Roger Everett. I'm the Environmental Health Director for Deschutes County. I've been working with DEQ from a county perspective since 1974, 5 years in Douglas, and then 20 years in Deschutes, so kind of a long relationship. And I'm here to testify to encourage your support of their budget also, and specifically address some on-site sewage disposal, the on-site sewage disposal program. Maybe excite you about on-site sewage disposal a little bit, because it's my bread and butter. But first of all, I think DEQ has done a pretty good job in our neck of the woods. This has not always been so, but in recent years they have been very willing to cooperate and coordinate with the counties, and it's a very welcome relationship. One reason I don't have as much hair is sometimes we've had our difficulties.
I think it's worthy of noting for the record, then, Mr. Everett, that Mr. Marsh seems to suffer from the same condition.
Must be that story. positive thing, DEQ was very active and helpful participant in our regional problem-solving program, the program that was through the LPDC. And they were a major player in that whole process, similar to what Commissioner Josie went through with gathering up a whole bunch of people to try and solve a problem. That's basically what that program did, and it's ongoing, but it seems like a real good process for a rural regional problem. As a result of the regional problem-solving program, the outcome, and DEQ's strong presence, we were able to receive $5.5 million in the grant money from EPA to study experimental on-site septic systems in southern Deschutes County. The state of Oregon, have not had any funds to look at new technology since 1980, almost 20 years. So as a result of the recognized expertise of DEQ and Deschutes County, the organization and relationship between DEQ and the county EPA saw fit to grant Oregon the lion's share of the funds that were for this experimental technology. And that's no small feat. Rhode Island got $1.5 million, Warren, Vermont got $3 million, and Oregon got $5.5 million. They showed a lot of confidence in DEQ. I'm going to shift gears a little bit here to the permit fees associated with the on-site program.
Question, Rickson King.
Southern a little geography. Would Lapine be Southern Deschutes County?
Yes.
So that's the area you're probably talking about.
Yeah, just south of Sun River down to the Klamath County line. Lapine's just a little bit above Klamath.
Okay, we had a pretty extensive orientation about the Lapine.
Yeah, it's the upper Deschutes Basin.
Okay, Mr. Did you have a number of questions?
Just one.
Just one.
You have one for
us? Yeah.
Yes, I do.
Don't believe it. It's come to our attention that in the metro area they have allowed cesspools to be for new construction until with a contract that, or an agreement, I guess, that in a certain period of time they would hook up to a treatment facility line. Have you folks had that? I know you've had a lot of growth in your area, too. Have you had that same kind of an agreement with DEQ?
No. for the most part, Ben's pretty aggressive in sewering that area. And the area that right around Ben, that it's there's a lot of rock. It's very difficult to do anything with on-site, and they've been pretty aggressive in getting sewers out to, for the most part, for new development. There are still, of course, Ben had drill holes for years, and that's, we still find a couple of those around, but no, we have, because of Ben's aggressiveness in sewering, I don't know that we've had quite that problem. Is that, Ken?
Apparently so.
The permit fees for on-site. In, over the last 10 years, DEQ has attempted to help the counties. The counties, the larger counties have kind of high-graded DEQ. We've taken the on-site program where we had enough volume to make it at least pay for itself, and left DEQ with some of the rural counties that are rather difficult to get around in. So, but anyway, DEQ has made an attempt to raise their fees so that these counties could have a fee-supported program without going into the general fund. And I think with the levels that we have had, we've been able to support a level of service expected with these fees. There are times when we're real busy in the spring when we have lapses, but for the most part, it covers the thing. Those fees have not been adjusted since 1995, and I know that Senate Bill 335 kind of unhooked us from those fees, and will allow the counties to plan for the future and cover our expenses and be accountable to the people that we're charging those expenses to. I think DEQ has probably time to adjust those fees somewhat. I do have a question about the repair permits. We've always tried to keep those within reach of most people. It's usually it's a surprise. You don't plan for your septic system to fail. And perhaps when you look at those fees, that might be one area to look at affordability. It's something that can really throw people a curve. I know as part of our $5.5 million, one of the items we're going to set up is a low interest loan for repair of permits in the future. That will be limited to just Southern Deschutes County at this point, but it may be something to think about for the future.
Question in the left hand team.
You get an anecdote about a deep pit. I just kind of lost the meaning of it.
Oh, the drill hole? The way that Ben, Redmond, Terrebon, the rock area that has lava rock, used to dispose of their sewage entirely was come out to a septic tank and drill a well down into the rock to a crack or crevice or cavern that would take it and then just let it run in there. That was customary, and Ben, I believe, we got Ben sewered in the late 70s. So from the very first, and we still find a handful of these out there. Someone figured out that probably wasn't the best way to do it. And the way to fix these things, they would throw a stick of dynamite down when they plugged up.
Did plug it up, or?
Yeah.
Oh, you all do.
It's an interesting thing. Yeah. You need the Central Oregon.
We do that with whales over in the coast.
Dynamite. And that's my last point, is that this is a public health program that impacts most rural citizens. And we try to dispose of our sewage so that it does not impact groundwater and surface water. And every well on those rural lots is a conduit into and out of the water table. And in Central Oregon, water is We actually have pretty good quality water and seem to have lots of it. We want to keep it that way. And I think everyone else would, too.
Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. I'd like to call Sharon Genassi and David Spangler.
Spangler.
Thank you.
Sharon Genassi, and this is David Spangler. We're here from the Northwest District Association in Portland, and we're both members of the Northwest District Association Board, but we're here today representing ourselves and a great number of Northwest citizens who have been very upset for many, many years about the strong industrial smells that we have in our neighborhood. We support full funding for Oregon DEQ. This will enable DEQ to adequately monitor for hazardous air pollutants, HAP, and 2.5 particulates in residential neighborhoods next to polluting industries, and to do the job of enforcement, which is the other part of their regulatory role. We live in the largest, most densely populated neighborhood in the state, next to a large industrial area. We have experienced strong industrial odors in our neighborhood for years, and we feel we should have the right to know what we are taking into our lungs. In 1997 and 1998, Northwest Portland neighbors used bucket air quality monitors and worked with DEQ, who placed a number of different monitors near neighbors' homes, to find over 70 toxic compounds in Northwest Portland air, including problem levels of lead and benzene. And we're continuing to monitor, actually, for particularly the metals for lead. We're setting out glass dishes that collect particulate matter, and then we have this amyloid. Our study indicates that clearly the DEQ has not been able to adequately carry out its responsibilities to protect Portland citizens throughout North Portland neighborhoods from toxic air pollutants. We're particularly concerned about the vulnerable, mostly low-income and minority neighbors who live closest to industry. Children and elderly people in these locations are more susceptible to asthma, cancer, and other illnesses caused by exposure to many toxic compounds. Given the seriousness of air quality problems in Portland, we would like to see adequate funding to enable DEQ to properly carry out their responsibilities to monitor and enforce the cleanup of Portland's airsheds. At a hearing called by Senator George in Portland in January, Greg Green, head of Oregon DEQ Air Quality Division, stated that monitoring would be carried out again this year in Northwest Portland, and that he has the authority to require capture equipment on oil companies' barge loading facilities in Portland. Our neighborhood and others received great quantities of benzene during the loading process. Benzene is a Class A carcinogen. Washington and California require capture equipment. So should Oregon. We are asking for the money, and we are asking DEQ to do the necessary enforcement to take care not only of Oregon's business interests, but its citizens as well. We want permanent, high-quality monitoring of our neighborhoods and enforcement against the polluters. Only with clean air will Portland be able to continue to prosper as a community. DEQ needs the money and the will to save us from becoming another Los Angeles. And this is from the heart, because we live with these smells 24 hours a day, and it's driving us crazy. People are getting sick. They're calling me up and telling me, one woman called me a year or two ago, and she said, there are 7 people on our 2 blocks of Overton that have died of cancer or have had cancer since the 50s. And I'm getting lots of anecdotal information like this all the time. A woman came to see me this week who had, she has multiple sclerosis. Her daughter has chronic fatigue syndrome. She also has multiple sensitivity to chemicals. The man across the street from her, who was a marathon runner running up and down Thurman for years and years and years, now has the worst case, she says, of chronic fatigue syndrome she's ever seen. The boy next door died of asthma. I mean, we could go on and on about things that are happening in our neighborhood. Unfortunately, we've never had a health study done at the neighborhood. So that's our next step. As a neighborhood, we're going to start a really specific, serious health study of the neighborhood so we can begin to talk to you about what really is going on at the ground level. But I can tell you, as a neighbor living there, it's very unpleasant and extremely unacceptable to live daily with very strong toxic smells coming out of that industrial neighborhood.
Okay. Question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you telling us that, in your opinion, the reason that DEQ has not been able to adequately carry out its responsibilities is for budgetary purposes, budgetary reasons?
We think it's really complicated. That's a complicated question, and there's a complicated answer for that. Partly that's true. They haven't had sufficient funding to do the monitoring that's necessary. What we need is a permanent, long-term, high-tech monitor in our neighborhood right next to the industrial area where we have a lot of fugitive emissions. So that's part of the answer. The other part of it is that really we're kind of at the beginning of a public waking up in this state about air. We have, for example, brochures in the city of Portland bragging about Bull Run water being so clean because it doesn't have certain chemicals that we're finding in the airship. So I think the DEQ in part reflects the public awareness on this issue, and they haven't done a lot of things. I think they're beginning, I hope they're beginning to really put up and take notice now. For example, the business of the capture equipment on the barge loading, unloading down the port there is extremely important, and they haven't required it here in Oregon where they did in California and Washington. And by not requiring that, we get all this fugitive benzene coming into our neighborhood, and then if the wind blows the other way, it goes into the other north neighborhood. And it goes up and down. We've got 700,000 people projected to move into Portland over the next 20 years, and nobody is really planning for this in terms of the airship. So that we get the 39 tons permit for just going to bing, 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 bing like this. Nobody's keeping track of the cumulative impact of all these different small toxic emissions that are going out there. And people who live in the inner city are on the front lines of all this, particularly the ones closest to industry.
That's good. Okay.
I found that pretty powerful testimony, and I'd be interested to see if, you know, DEQ, air force might be able to respond, but I could certainly wait for that if it's possible that, you know, Mr. Stenger had remarks.
I think I would like to bring to the attention that our testimony isn't about auto pollution, it's not about cars. We're concerned about the high levels of industrial pollution that impact the urban area of Portland as a whole.
Senator, could you repeat your name for the record? Yeah,
Mr. Chair and Representative King. I'm David Spangler, and I am a board member for the Northwest District Association, along with Sharon. I wanted to use some of my comments to augment what Sharon says and not to repeat, but our testimony is not about auto emissions and auto pollution or what you might call mobile sources. We're concerned about the growing problem in Portland of industrial air pollution. As Sharon has stated, there are numbers of permits that are routinely okayed that increase industrial pollution. Our neighborhood is adjacent to the major industrial area in Portland, and so we're more highly impacted than other parts of Portland, but I think the whole city is impacted by industrial pollution. And so I view the DEQ as an agency that is evolving. I don't think it's a finished product, and that their role is evolving, and our relationship with them is evolving. For instance, we are beginning to form a relationship with Greg Green, who manages their air department, and so that he's beginning to hear our concerns more directly than in the past when they didn't really know we were out there. The other part of my testimony that I'd like to emphasize is that we all breathe the same air. Everybody breathes it. And it's in, I've lived in Oregon almost my entire life. I was born here. And the air is not getting better in Oregon. It's getting worse. I've lived in a number of communities, and in all of those communities, the air is worse now than it was when I was a child. And that includes Klamath Falls, Medford, Eugene, Portland, the Springfield area. And so I think that's the thing that I would like to emphasize. The role of the DEQ has to begin to evolve to address these concerns in the urban areas where air quality is beginning to be more and more an issue.
Other questions? Do you have follow-up questions?
I think it's similar to air quality generally too, but my understanding is that Medford would be an exception to that.
As it's better now than it was? Okay. I haven't lived there for some time.
Further questions from the committee? I guess I have the perceptions that I have about some of the farming is that we have traditionally pursued agricultural activities in rural areas, and as these areas build up, there's a natural conflict between residents who come into a community and they are interfacing with essentially industrial operations, chemical sprays, fertilizer applications, herbicides and pesticides, noise, in-migration of guest workers and smudge pots and all kinds of, I guess you call it the pig farm syndrome. I don't know what other name to refer to it. And I know that Portland's long had an affordable housing problem, and many of the most affordable residents have been in them adjacent to industrial neighborhoods in typical community development. So I think you get there's an attraction there because of the affordability of housing, but it's also close proximity to industrial operations. No question that we need industrial operations and affordable housing. But I guess I'd ask you, how long have you lived in residence in the area, in the neighborhood? And have you seen an influx of population in that neighborhood, residential development there? And has that exacerbated the conflict?
I could speak to part of my growing up years were in Medford, and my uncle was a prominent orcharder in the Medford area, and I'm very familiar with the problem that you mentioned regarding people moving into an area where there were traditional agricultural uses and agricultural spin-off of smells or whatever, and then people move into the area and then you begin to have complaints around it. And of course, in the family there was a lot of resentment for people moving in and complaining about the smudge pots or the spraying that would go on, and it seemed that it made a lot more sense for them to not locate the residential areas close to where in his case, the pear industry, they were major pear people, was located. And I never really understood the zoning thing on that, because you can't have a pear industry or a major agricultural industry and then put residents next to it and expect it to work. Well, I had that experience growing up, and I understand both sides of the issue. And then having lived in Portland, I've lived in the neighborhood now for 9 years. And there is very definitely, every people know in the neighborhood, that the closer you get to the industrial area, the cheaper the rents are. But I would like to add that Portland is planning huge amounts of infill population growth that is directly adjacent and downwind of this industrial area. And those people, as they get there and they find out about the air, or they just smell the air, they're not going to be pleased. And it is not low-income housing. These are loft units and apartments that are selling for $200,000 and up. And I think those people are going to be angry that they were led to believe that Oregon had clean air, and they got to Portland and found out that it wasn't. I personally am very angry because I moved into the neighborhood to get out of Eugene, because we have a major field burning air problem in Eugene that has not gotten better during the 20 to 30 years I lived in Eugene. And so I came to Portland and got to the neighborhood and found that I was now in a situation of experiencing major industrial pollution. And in the 9 years since I've got there, the industrial pollution has gotten worse, not better. And a lot of that is the tank farm problem, which is the unloading and offloading of petroleum products and the barge problem that Sharon mentioned. But
we have other fugitive emissions that are also a problem.
That's not the only one.
It's kind of a coefficient of population increase. It reminds me of the 3 million people that moved to Denver for the clean air.
But there has to be a correction to take that into account. I mean, the DEQ has to do a job of enforcement. Industry has to realize that there are people living there, and they can't just throw pollution out through the roof. It's what we have in our neighborhood. There's a lot of pollution that's coming out through roofs and open doors and windows and that sort of thing.
We will, we've had the hearing in Portland with Senator Georgetown.
Yeah.
There will be others, I'm certain of that. The agency has been making presentations. We had probably an hour and a half with Mr. Green. That was one of the more interesting parts of the discussion that we had in committee. So it is an issue that we're concerned with. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to call Lily Tiffany and Bob Eamon. Thank you. And we're going to try and finish our testimony by 10 after, so please don't read your testimony, just summarize, and then we have three more folks that would like to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Lily Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities, and today to provide testimony on behalf of the League is Bob Eamon. He's City Councilor in the City of Pendleton and also chairs the League Water Committee. So.
First of all, I want to just address three issues rather briefly in the budget and make one comment. And the comment is that as Representative Jensen can also attest to the...
you'll need to announce your name for the record.
I'm Bob Eamon, E-H-M-A-N-N, City Council in the City of Pendleton.
Awesome.
And thank you. The testimony of the fellow from Astoria sounds very much, if he hadn't said Astoria, the City of Pendleton with regards to Harris Pine Mill. The DEQ staff was marvelous in helping us out there also. I want to address, first of all, the Environmental Partnership for Oregon Communities part of the budget. This is a program for very small cities, less than 2,000 population. Well, really, there is no expertise to meet the requirements imposed on them. Oftentimes, the city recorder, maybe the mayor, if they pay the mayor and the police chief, and that's about it. There is no water staff or sewage staff, whatever. And in the past, these folks have just had to throw up their hands in terms of the requirements. It's no help to just tell them that, well, you're going to have $100 a month sewer bills or whatever, or you're going to have to raise taxes in order to pay for these regulations that you have to comply with. The EPOC program, which I have also served on the advisory board, has been one of those programs that has really helped those small cities. And I've seen that myself, sitting on the advisory board, where they come in and we go over these problems and make practical solutions or suggest practical solutions for them. The second one, and I would urge you all to continue to fund that. It's been a statewide program, anywhere from NISA to Vail to Lakeview, other cities throughout the state. Second thing I want to address is the Community Solutions Team. It's a very similar argument to keep that in the budget as I made just for EPOC, the Environmental Partnerships Program. The program that we need to have to make practical solutions for cities in our state. Right now, oftentimes if you're not in the EPOC program, you should still get some advice there, but you need to have a more comprehensive approach. This is what's going to make it happen. And cities throughout the state, whether they're 500 or a half million population, need that kind of cooperation. finally, water permitting is very near and dear to our heart. That's due to lose more positions in the budget. That costs us. And we have to file a permit, application, renewal, or a permit, start out with the, we have to study the problem when it's applied for. We have to then study it again when they get around to acting upon it. And many times that can be considerably later, and we have to have to pay for the same information twice. Furthermore, and probably at least as important, is the city can and does and do face lawsuits when we don't have permits. Some citizen action groups, and you're familiar with most of them, I'm sure, already in this committee. That can be very expensive for the cities and extremely risky. And, you know, to the point of some of the things they would like to do is essentially shut down the city. And we can't afford that. I don't think the state can afford that for our cities and communities throughout the state. We need to have a program for permit applications and renewals that is efficient and is adequately staffed so they can get the work out. It's not adequately staffed now. Cutting back on it is just going to make the problem a lot worse. That's what I have.
Okay. Mr. Tiffin, do you have anything to add to that?
Mr. Chair, no, I'd just be happy to respond to any questions.
Questions from the committee? Thank you. Kathleen Gotten?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kathleen Gott, and I represent the Oregon Models Industry Council. I actually wasn't planning on testifying today, but became motivated after listening to the Northwest Neighbors comments. A number of you were present at for Senator George's hearing in Portland last January, where some of these same issues were addressed. One of the industrial clients that's in that area is one of my clients. It's ESCO Corporation. And ESCO has been working with the Northwest Neighbors for a number of years and has been doing monitoring, has met all the DEQ requirements, and in fact, after the January testimony, did write a letter back to DEQ indicating that they are interested in participating in any further monitoring that DEQ might like to partake. There are a number of industrial clients that are in that area beyond just there are a number of different sources of pollution. We believe that large contributors to that happen to be some of the mobile sources of pollution that need to be addressed. Highway 30 goes right through the area, and there's a number of others. I'm probably in somewhat of a unique position because I also happen to live in the area. So I live with the conditions that they have expressed to you and have been a happy resident of Northwest Portland for probably about 15 years, so, and have not suffered any of the ill effects that, you know, I know that there certainly are smells that one smells from time to time, but it's very difficult to identify what the sources of those are. If in part that's from some of the vehicle transportation or the trucking industry that's by there, but we welcome the opportunity to address those issues further, and we certainly welcome any of the members of this committee also to come and to visit the ESCO site if you're so inclined to do that. Their doors are open. We'd be happy to give you a tour of the facility and show you what investments they have made to try to mitigate some of these problems.
Questions? Call Mr. Phelps from Clearwater Technology and also Mr. Porter. Oh, I just have to. Yeah, Mr. Rogers Porter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ray Phelps. I'm here representing Clearwater Technology from Southern Oregon, Jackson and Josephine County. Just wanted to add our voice to that you heard earlier from the gentleman from Bend, and that is funding of the DEQ request for enforcement purposes as well as for treating of the septic and working on innovative septic programs. our company is in that business, and the lack of enforcement has been a difficulty for them and others who are trying to bring innovative technology in to be successful. And we need that enforcement component. That concludes my testimony.
Very succinct. Thank you. Questions from the panel? Mr. Porter?
My name is Rogers Porter. I own Northwest Sanitation. I'm here today. Northwest Sanitation is a portable toilet company. I think there's a few members who have seen me here recently talking a couple other bills. It's not a sexy industry, but we have worked very, very closely with DEQ on the advisory committee for the last few years. A couple of years ago, many of you may not know this, that clear back to 1994, fees were changed for the on-site program, and in that process of changing, those fees were subsequently rolled back. Now, those fees are set through a full public hearing process with input from all around the state, and eventually, and usually, is heard at the EPC, which I think most of you realize is appointed by the governor and people on that that commission. Two years ago, we made some rule changes again. Again, we recommended, it wasn't presented at that budget, that the fees be increased. This is the third time that we are pushing for increasing the fees. These are fees assessed against the businesses primarily and through permitting. And this program is, as I understand it, is totally self-sufficient on fees. In other words, fees paid for the entire program. We're interested in this program improving, we being pumpers, because there are problems out there. In fairness to the DEQ, they have not had the resources necessary to run the program. When we take a complaint or have problems, they have limited resources to respond with. So I would be for, you know, nobody likes passing increased licensing fees on themselves, but I have talked to many people around the state who are also pumpers, and there is a lot of the pumpers who are supportive of increasing these fees.
Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Catherine Donata.
Chair Ferrioli, members of the committee, I'm Catherine Zanata, Governmental Affairs Manager of the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. My testimony is being handed out to you today. In summary, I'd like to say that the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association members are supportive of appropriate and adequate funding for a fully functional DEQ that strikes a balance between the needs of all Oregonians. We encourage your support of this, and we wish to be part of the solution rather than an obstacle in resolving any outstanding budgetary issues for the DEQ, and we wish to be helpful during the subcommittee's budget deliberations.
Questions from Spinetta? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony, and I'll ask if there's anyone else here present that wishes to add to the public record. I'm folks that will keep the public record open for a period for the written communications if anybody still desires to submit those. We have a caucus at 10:15 on the Senate, 10:30 is the Senate session, and 10:45 is the House session for today. Mr. Rocco, where stand we on the DEQ vote?
Mr. Chair, we'll continue tomorrow at 8:30 with the continuation of the waste management cleanup program, and hopefully we'll include that tomorrow and then get into the water quality division. Finished up with agency management probably by next Tuesday, I believe.
And Tom, you can ask by which way to begin moving our budget out of the work session, so we'll be looking at that. Scheduling some agency budgets in the next few days. Any questions before we adjourn?
Seeing none, the business of the committee is concluded for today. We will reassemble tomorrow at 8:30.